The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the final stream for tonight, and it is with Endeavour. Endeavour has appeared on Millennial quite a few times. Let me just find out how many times. I think it must be four or five now.
I think this is my fifth time.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Okay, well, I'm sure most people will know you, but welcome back, and please introduce yourself just for anyone who doesn't know you.
All right, so I'm a YouTuber, though I've gotten into Substack as well this past year, so I'm just into content creation, which is pretty much in line with dissident right politics. I think that's pretty much sums it up.
Right, I was just checking whether the Odyssey stream has started, and it has, so that's good. All right, well, you weren't on last Millennial, and I'm sorry about that. It was just a matter of logistics. It was pure logistics. But we did do a lot, partly in compensation for that, but also just because we wanted to. We did a set of recordings earlier this year. We rendezvoused in London, and I think we did about three or four hours of recording. It was an awful
Yeah, it was quite a lot. Yeah, I got a lot of good content out of that.
Yeah, so I enjoyed it.
I did too. I thought that it turned out really well. So as I was traveling in January earlier this year, the very beginning of the year, I met you in London, and we spoke about a number of things, and I thought that what we could do is kind of a follow up to some of the things that we spoke about in January, because I feel that this year has been a really good year for us. I'm a lot more optimistic than I was at the beginning of last year, and certainly more than I was than I was 2 years ago. If you remember when I was on Millennial last time, I think I remember that being quite a depressing and black-pilling stream. But I think I have a lot more positive things to say this time around, because I feel that this year we've had a number of positive developments. You know, it doesn't feel like 2016. Where there was all of that action, there was Trump and Brexit and everything. But I feel that maybe there was kind of this naivety that in 2016 that, well, oh, Trump's won, and now, well, we're going to have our God Emperor and our ethno state. And I mean, obviously that was naive. That never actually happened. But I think, though, what we can be optimistic about is that positive change is going to come for us gradually. And I think it's just looking at how things are developing. And there are a lot of positives from the past year.
Well, also, it's a matter of don't interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. Not that we could interrupt them, but they're doing a lot of the work for us. It seems to be all kind of falling apart. Now, obviously not totally, or is it happening slowly? But I completely agree with you that there are some several things that happen here that justify optimism. And to compare it with 2016, yeah, I actually kind of prefer this to 2016-15 because that was kind of stupid. I mean, in retrospect, it was kind of dumb. And naive, and I enjoyed it, and it was a thrill for everyone, but we didn't know what we were up against, and we didn't know how crap Trump would be, so we were setting ourselves up for disappointment. This time round, it's different. I think we're all hardened, battle-scarred, and of course, I should acknowledge that there are people who've been in this much longer than either of us, who've been waiting much longer than we have, for the events of this year, things that have happened. But my point is that we're all a bit older and wiser than we were in 2016. And I have a good feeling about next year.
So some people in the chat were saying, oh, am I coming through too loudly? It looks like I am.
Oh, wait a bit. I'll turn your volume down. Or do you want to do that?
Yeah, could you do that? I think I'm coming through too loud.
There we go. It should be better now.
Okay, so in the chat, is that better? I'm not killing people. I'm not destroying people's ears. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to mess with people that way. If everything is fine, just put that in the Odyssey chat. Perfect now. Okay, excellent. Sorry about that, folks. I guess a few of the things that we could get into. I think the big thing for us this year, it may not be the biggest news story of the year, but the thing that's the most relevant for us, I would say, is the developments that have gone on Twitter, or X as it's now called. Because I remember at the beginning of the year when you and I spoke, we spoke about how Musk bought Twitter, and we were trying to guess, well, where is his head at? I think that we both agreed that Musk is certainly not our guy, but he's also not the systems guy either. He's not the kind of guy that most in the system would want to have in control of a large social media platform.
Of course not. And you know, this is why it annoys me when people say he's controlled opposition. You know, if he was controlled opposition, he wouldn't be letting people back on. He wouldn't be doing a lot of, he wouldn't be pissing off the ADL. He wouldn't be telling advertisers to go fuck themselves. I mean, come on.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I will say that one thing is there's nothing that can make your followers on Twitter or Telegram or YouTube, whatever, nothing makes them angrier than suggesting that something good might have actually happened. Have you ever noticed that?
I do wonder about that. If people are so sort of accustomed to failure and to everything being bullshit that they think, well, everything is bullshit. So they refuse to see something good when it's there. Now, again, I'm not saying that Elon Musk is our guy, there are these tremendous or whatever. I'm simply saying he's better for us than he is bad for us. For God's sake, at least accept that much positivity.
Oh, yeah, because I think that it's a net positive by far. Now, again, I'm not saying that he's our guy. However, he's definitely pushed things in the right direction for us. And, you know, I think that a lot of this is that Elon genuinely, while he might not agree with everything that we would believe, he genuinely is opposed to a lot of the things that the broader elite are pushing. So he definitely he genuinely is against, you know, against what has come to be known as wokeism. You know, I think maybe he might be coming at it from a bit of a naive perspective, a kind of a 90s centrist liberal kind of perspective. But nonetheless, I think he genuinely is against that stuff. But what was interesting is we spoke about this at the beginning of the year, was his clashes with the Anti-Defamation League and the organized Jewish community. It's been fascinating to see how that has developed over this year, because when he bought Twitter, it's really interesting that Elon Musk was not an anti-Semite. Elon Musk did not buy Twitter to turn it into a right-wing platform for people to spout off. Things like, he didn't buy this to give people a platform to talk about race realism and the Jewish question and mass immigration.
Of course,
he's just someone who's more open to. Free speech. He's someone who's more open to discourse. And all that it took for the Anti-Defamation League to declare war on the richest man in the world and go nuclear on him, try to sink the company, all it took was for him not to give the Anti-Defamation League 100% control over everything that goes on the platform. I remember one quote that you had from our talk earlier this year was that with the organized Jewish community, you can give them 95% of what they want, and then they will go absolutely nuclear over not getting that last 5%.
Yes, and they'll be outraged that you didn't give them that 5%. That's all they'll talk about.
Oh yeah, and they'll go to war with you, and they did that with Elon Musk. It wasn't even that he himself believed in. I have to imagine things for him have changed now in that regard. But it's not even that he bought the platform because he wanted to give our guys in particular a greater reach. All he did was say that, well, on the platform we're going to have more free speech, and for them to go nuclear, all it took was the idea that somebody might be not Musk himself, but somebody on the platform might be allowed to say something that they don't like. And then, you know, we can also tie this back to even before that was the whole yay controversy from the end of last year. Now that, I mean, I think, you know, Kanye, he's kind of a bit crazy. I'm not putting too much hope in, I'm not putting like too much of my faith in him or anything, but you also see how poorly the ADL played that one as well. Now, I think that he kind of scored an own goal at the end with, like, you know, the whole Alex Jones interview. And I think that
ludicrous.
Yeah. I think that was kind of ridiculous. And a lot of the ground that was gained was lost on that thing. But again, though, like, why didn't they just brush it off? Like, all they had to do when Ye was talking about this stuff at the end of last year, all they had to do was just say, oh, that's Kanye being crazy again. And, oh, well, this guy's out of his mind. He's off his rocker.
They could have made a joke out of it. Like, yeah. He's not even masking his anti-Semitism.
Or, well, with the Kanye West Kanye West interview on Alex Jones, I guess you could say he was masking his anti-Semitism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right that they overreacted to, well, they overreact to everything. And, you know, that's kind of stereotypical.
Yeah. And with the yay thing, they could have just brushed that off and it would have just been a flash in the pan. It would have just been, Kanye West, I think everybody has known that he's someone his entire career. He's kind of a clown. He loves controversy. And, you know, they could have just brushed that off and then it would have been out of the news within a week. But then they made this huge thing out of it and amplified it much further than it ever had to be. And then you follow that up with
literally the Barbara Streisand effect, ironically.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with this. I know Kanye West is one of the richest men in the world, one of the most famous men in the world. And something that when he says something, that's going to cause a stir nonetheless. But, you know, it felt like they could have just laughed it off, but instead, let's be honest, it was ridiculous. I mean, I don't think that Kanye West is the source to go to on, an in-depth knowledge on the JQ. I think I'd recommend Kevin McDonald on that one. But
yeah,
it was something that they could have brushed off. And I wonder because they do have this history of overreach and they do have this history of overreacting things and doing it to themselves. But I even wonder, like, have they even gotten worse in that regard? Because one thing you see in the 2000s is there was a lot of media that's designed to undermine people talking about the JQ. So something like South Park, the point of the character Eric Cartman in South Park and the jokes that he makes about Kyle, the Jewish kid, the point is that it's putting anti-Semitism in the mouth of somebody who's obviously supposed to be insane. And therefore, if anybody ever actually brings up an issue of Jewish influence, well, in the libtard mind, the first thing that comes up is either Borat, who, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen was Jewish himself. Either comes up is this kind of caricature of this antisocial weirdo who
it's misdirection by association. It's neutering something.
Yeah, and I feel like they could have easily done that with Kanye West, but they chose to take it seriously.
It's interesting to try to analyze why that is, because in theory they should still have the comedy talent, you know, to do this kind of thing, but it's as if they all take themselves so seriously now, and I don't just mean, you know, organized Jewish organizations. I mean, even celebrities, you know, everything is so on tenterhooks that nobody can really. The only thing that you can joke about and mock is you know, Trump voters, racists, Nazis, but everything else, everyone is extremely po-faced about, extremely tense about. So there can be no. There can be no mocking of anything, and no self-deprecation, but weirdly, even when it came to things like the alt-right, they couldn't mock that either. When they tried to, it was just shit. It was just utterly unfunny.
Well, so, yeah, because it's so clear. I mean, comedy in some ways, it's subversive because it has to. It has to poke at certain taboos and things like that. So, you know, maybe mocking Christians in the 1980s might have been funny, but when you're doing it, when you're mocking Christianity and Trump voters and racists and Nazis in the 2020s, the time when we have drag queen story hour and Black Lives Matter and all of this when this is like being officially endorsed by the federal government of the United States and the United Nations and the EU, when all of them are pushing this, you know, to come out and say, well, what you need to be worried about is racists or Trump voters or those crazy Christians, it just falls flat.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the early 2000s, it was still funny, this kind of thing. You know, as a liberal, you know, I was a liberal at that time, and it was still funny. But now at this point, it's no.
I remember even before I was politically conscious at all, when I was like 12 years old, I remember laughing my ass off about these jokes about George Bush from Mad Magazine. And even back then, they were really good at that. I mean, I absolutely despise Jon Stewart, also known as John Lieberwitz, but I'll give him credit that he actually was funny back in the 2000s. And this is why he was so effective at pushing the vile that he did, the trash that he did push.
Auron McIntyre did a good video about him a few weeks ago, about how he's just, his moment is over. Because you can't be irreverent anymore, really, about anything. We live in a very, you know, because his time was, as you say, the 2000s, the first half of the 2010s. And since wokery has taken over show business, you just cannot be irreverent now. It's weirdly, it's almost like a sin. It's sacrilegious.
Yeah. And you have to be absolutely doctrinaire on everything. And I mean, to bring that back to the whole to the issue of Musk and Twitter, it wasn't that he was explicitly opposed to them in any way, or that was ever his intentions. But I feel that they've kind of made it that way. And I think that one of the big white pills of this year is that the influence of the organized Jewish community has been discussed at elite levels, which I don't think we've seen since the Second World War. And with, for example, the Ban the ADL campaign, and you know, props to Keith Woods for that, because I think that was a great piece of work that he pulled off and that everyone on Twitter got on board with. That one really well, and that made them look really bad too. And then there was the whole Gaza conflict, and we can get into that as well. But it's being discussed at a higher level than it has been in decades. And
I don't certainly think in our lifetimes, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I, I've I would imagine that I would imagine that it would be even in the lifetimes of the baby boomers, for that matter. And it's primarily happening on Twitter, or X, as we now call it. It's primarily happening on Twitter. And I think that one of the primary reasons for that is because they made such made themselves such a target they made themselves such a target by going after the platform simply for not acquiescing to 100% of their demands. So,
and it's not just Twitter that they've gone after. They've built up almost like money in the bank. They've built up so much resentment against themselves in various people in recent years, because Jonathan Greenblatt, I don't know when it was that he took over, but he has been a awful front man or leader, CEO for the ADL. He's dreadful. He comes across badly all the time, every single public appearance. And so, and he's just very aggressive with other organizations and with individuals. So the ADL is no longer some smart player, like I believe it was in the 2000s with Abe Foxman. It's now this clumsy, feckless, tactless monster that just sort of rolls around, attacking many different people, and people notice. It's now, and it's the same again. It's the same with Hope Not Hate over here, for example. Everywhere there are these hall monitors who are utterly humorless, and their job is to prevent people from making jokes, from making commentary, whether it's humor or not. Their job is to shut people up again and again and again and again and again. And they're seen doing this again and again and again by much more normie types. They see this. The ADL, Hope Not Hate, the SPLC, constantly demanding that this be shut down, that be shut down, that person's life be ruined, that person's reputation be smeared, that person be debanked, that person be deplatformed. It's all they ever do. And if that's all you ever do, other people are going to eventually think you're a humorless fucking cunt. You're a fucking piece of shit who's just sapping the joy out of life and setting people up against each other. Fuck off. Which is what they should have been told years and years ago.
Oh, yeah. But you know what? What their power has relied on for such a long time is the goodwill that they built up following the Second World War, the sympathy which white people afforded the Jewish community following the Second World War. That's what the ADL's power is based on. And, you know, I even remember as I was kind of starting to get interested in politics, this would have been, I'd say, 2014, 2015. I came across a few websites like the ADL's website, and for a lot of people that I follow now, I saw them on the ADL's website or the SPLC's website, and the moral dilemma I thought to myself at the time, you know, before I was red-pilled, was am I being a bad person by listening to somebody like this? Of course the ADL site says, well, this person's a hater. This person's a hate leader. The SPLC has their hate list. Their list of official official haters.
I mean, yeah. I could talk about the concept of hate. I have done many times already, so I don't need to go into it really. But it's interesting that in the end they sort of packaged. See, everything seems to become streamlined and packaged eventually so that it's digestible for midwits and the masses. And all of these concepts and whole fields of research and expertise are now packaged just in the simple word hate. It's just all hate. That's all there is to it. It's all it is. Doesn't matter what it's called. Doesn't matter what it refers, what it talks about. It's just hate. Hate, hate, hate. And anyone who purveys it is a purveyor of hate, and nothing but a purveyor of hate. There's nothing else to them, nothing else you would ever want to know about them. If you did want to know anything else about them, that makes you a bad person too. I mean, you know, eventually people just tire of this.
Yeah. And I mean,
it's fatiguing. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic that they're called the Anti-Defamation League when all they do is defamation. That is literally the goal of the Anti-Defamation League is defamation. That is the entire purpose of them. But what's interesting though is that so they built up their cultural political power and based on this moralism that what we would call Holocaustianity. And I know that the laws in the UK are such that I'll say that we're not here talking about alleged war crimes that happened during World War II. This is not what this stream is about. But it's this kind of narrative that they built up the what's the correct phrase, like the moral righteousness. The moral righteousness of organizations like the Anti-Defamation League or the SPLC was built off of what would be called now Holocaustianity. So the narrative that, well, the worst thing in history was the National Socialists in World War II, and they were evil because they were anti-Semitic and racist, and that the worst thing in the world is intolerance, and the most dangerous thing we cannot allow this white ethnocentrism to ever return, because if that ever comes back, well, then it's going to be these historical events are going to repeat themselves. And this is the moral righteousness which the ADL built up its cultural power off of. But that's just slipping away. That's just slipping right through their fingertips, because like you mentioned with Jonathan Greenblatt, he's just going on there. He's just going on the media. He's going on social media saying that, well, we have to ban all of these people. Well, we have a problem with TikTok. Now, I'm not too optimistic about TikTok, but he did say this in a call recently that we have a TikTok problem because people on TikTok are sharing anti-Semitic views. And he's basically just going out there demanding that
an entire platform change its ways. I mean, that I think that starts to seem an outrageous demand. Whereas in 2016, 17, 18, when these platforms were doing it voluntarily, it seemed much more reasonable to normies. I think when he comes out and demands it, it sounds really bad.
Yeah, and everyone's just starting to feel like, who the hell are you to decide what views people are allowed to express? Who made you the arbiter of what political discourse is acceptable? Since when, you know, nobody elected the Anti-Defamation League to decide.
Nobody ever would.
nobody ever would elect them. But nobody ever consented to the idea that they get to be the arbiter of what political speech is to be allowed or not. But yet they're just out there demanding that everyone they dislike be ruthlessly censored and have their freedom of speech crushed. I mean, if someone like Greenblatt got his way, I think that everybody who he didn't like would be in jail. These people they're kind of like this runaway train with no brakes.
Yes,
and I think that's so. Like we talked about with Musk, they didn't need to do that, but like just the idea that they might lose an inch of ground. They take 10 miles, but the idea that they just lose an inch, they go absolutely nuclear. And it has really bitten bitten them in the ass this year, because with like the ban the ADL campaign, a lot of the people that got on board with that. Now I know the ADL didn't end up getting banned from social media. However, it did expose them to a much greater degree than they had been ever, really, at least on social media.
It's
oh, absolutely.
It certainly didn't do them any favors. You could never say that they were better at the other end of it than they had been at the start. That would be absurd.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah, it was definitely a net positive. But what you saw also with that is people getting on board who you wouldn't have imagined doing that earlier. So obviously all of our guys were on board with the whole ban the ADL hashtag. But that, I mean, that's to be expected. However, you really saw that across what's called Conservatism Inc. or the center right, and then even the center itself, you see that people, a lot of people are pissed off about them. Even, believe it or not, Ben Shapiro came out and said that against the ADL. Now, you know, maybe we can get into him a bit later when we talk about the Israel-Palestine issue. But, well, it shows that with Con Inc. and the center right and the center, it shows one of two things. Either A, they've pissed off these people as well, and now the ADL's own enemies are not simply just what they call the far right. So it's not simply just the white positive sphere anymore. And then also, you know, they've always had like a problem with the Palestinian stuff, and it's not just that anymore. They have pissed off the entirety of the right and the center as well. Who knows? Maybe even some people on the left are getting sick of the ADL. It seems kind of doubtful, but
Be surprised at this stage. But this is why you don't want to alienate yourself and isolate yourself. And that's what they've done. The thing is, when they were smarter, that's what they tried to do to their enemies. They tried to isolate their enemies by alienating them from potential allies. Mm-hmm. But what they've done under Jonathan Greenblatt is they've done it to themselves. You know, this is, you don't want to be isolated. You don't, and some people I think are quite, they sparg out about this and they say, well, I don't care if I end up isolated. I'm just speaking the truth. Well, look at the position that the ADL's in now, and you should see why you should hide your power level, you know, and just be diplomatic. Because what they've done is weakened their own position by multiplying their enemies. And they've done that, as you say, by being unreasonable and far too aggressive, far too demanding. Having got us, or the likes of us, banned from mainstream platforms, they then moved on to loads of other people. And as you say, they've pissed off milquetoast conservatives and even centrists.
Well, they're taking credit for the banning of Donald Trump on Twitter. And when Elon Musk let him back on, they were outraged at the idea that a former president would be allowed on social media, and they were taking credit for him, getting him banned in the first place. And Donald Trump had like about 70 million Americans voted for him. I don't know the exact number, but tens of millions of Americans voted for Donald Trump in the past election. And they're telling tens of millions of people that the person that they wanted to be president of the United States should not be allowed on social media.
So what the ADL is saying there is, we are your enemy. 70 million Americans, we are your enemy. And that's a fucking stupid, sorry, I keep swearing, that's a very unwise thing for them to have done there. They should not, like, just as a matter of self-preservation, they shouldn't want to take credit for getting Trump taken off social media.
Yeah, I mean, they used to be a lot more quiet about this stuff. I don't know what it was like in the 2000s and stuff, but did you hear about the ADL that much? I don't think
I didn't, but I mean, I wasn't looking into this kind of thing back then, but I don't
know. As far as I know, the only time you'd hear, I mean, obviously some people who have been in this a lot longer than you and I have would have heard about the ADL. But as far as I know, like, it would probably have just been that in the newspaper when there was some, like, you know, when they wanted to do some smear piece on, when some newspaper or news station wanted to do a smear piece on some right winger, they'd say, well, the Anti-Defamation League has said that this is a hate group, or that this person spreads, revisionist history or whatever it is. I imagine that would have been the only time you would have heard of them. Would have been when they would have just been referenced when there was a hit piece on some right winger in the newspaper. But these days, this is another fact of social media. You hear about them all the time because every single time Jonathan Greenblatt goes on one of these shows, it gets clipped, it gets posted on social media, and you, like you said, they're telling tens of millions of people that they're their enemy. But not only that, they're also telling them that the people that you vote for should not be allowed on social media, and by extension, you should not. Not only are we your enemy, but you should not even have any say in the public square at all. So saying to half of the United States that they should not have any say in political discourse at all. That's what the ADL is effectively saying.
Jonathan Greenblatt is effectively saying there, if I could, I would disenfranchise 70 million Americans. And Americans are going to hear that and think, well, who the hell are you? And it's a perfectly legitimate question.
And I think that's a good way to segue to the next point that's relevant to this as well. It's the Israel-Palestine conflict. And what's developed with that. Now, I wrote an article earlier this year. It was inspired by Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein. I think everyone's familiar with the story, even if you haven't read the novel. It's this scientist who, Dr. Frankenstein, who reanimates a corpse. He figures out how to bring a corpse back to life and instill life into a reconstructed corpse. And then it turns out to be this monster who goes on to kill his family and destroy his entire life. You know, I wrote my article inspired by that. I titled it Dr. Goldenstein's Monster on Substack. And that one seems to have been kind of a hit. My point with that article is when you look at the Israel-Palestine conflict, this one, I think that we have to, I think that there are a lot of positives we can take out of this, but it's important not to get too optimistic about it because there are two elements to this. So with the whole Israel-Palestine conflict, what we're seeing right now is that they've, again, much like with the ADL, losing their moral high ground when it comes to you know, who should be allowed to speak and who is a hater, and they're losing their high ground with that. The state of Israel is absolutely losing their high ground. They're losing a massive amount of prestige. But what I was more interested in, I'm not so much interested in the actual conflict itself. I'm not going to lie. I really couldn't care less what's going on in the Middle East. I think it's not our conflict, and it's not something that I'm too concerned about. I'm concerned about our people. But I'm really interested in this political divide in the West, even though I do not sympathize with Israel and I do not sympathize with Palestine either. The pro-Palestinian movement in some ways is kind of a Frankenstein monster for the organized Jewish community. Because when you I first need to clarify the pro-Palestine movement and Palestinians and Hamas, they are just as much our enemies as the organized Jewish community and Zionism. So I don't want to give too much false optimism in that regard. But when you consider what this movement is comprised of, I can't help but thinking that the organized Jewish community did this to themselves. Because think about the factors that go into this. Who sympathizes with Palestine in the West? Muslims. Muslims hate the state of Israel. They do not have a very good relationship with Jews. And well, why are there a bunch of Muslims in the West? Well, it's because of open borders, immigration policy, mass immigration, and no one has been pushing that to a greater degree than the organized Jewish community. Not only that, our buddy Horace made some great videos a couple years ago where he didn't only talk about how Jews were involved in Muslim immigration to the United Kingdom, but how they also have worked tirelessly to promote these Muslim organizations and fund these mosques and Islamic education and just embed Muslims in the United Kingdom as deeply as possible. So they don't just work to bring them there. They've also worked tirelessly to give them political clout as well. And it's because, you know, they kind of view they kind of view Muslims in the West in a country like Britain the same way that they would view, I'd say, blacks in America. It's this hammer that they use to beat the white population with. And then who else is in the pro-Palestine movement? It's a bunch of a lot of white leftists as well. And yeah, the way that
often types.
Yeah. And the way that they're looking at it, and again, these people are our enemies as well. So I'm not saying that they're our friends, but the way that they're looking at it, they incorrectly view Jews as being white, or at least being a lot whiter than Palestinians. And they've had their heads filled with this post-colonial, anti-racist, third worldist trash for years and years. And now when they look at something like the Israel-Palestine conflict, now Jews are not white, but they are under the impression that this is a white settler colonialist state oppressing poor brown people. And now this label of white oppressor is being put onto Israel and Israelis and the Zionist lobby. And well, gee, who has been pushing these narratives throughout the West for the last 75 years? Well, none other than the organized Jewish community themselves. So many factors are involved in this that, and then the other thing to point out is, so there's Muslims, there's white leftists who are, you know, and a lot of them are communists who side with Palestine. And then there are also other non-white people who might not be Muslims. But at the same time, though, let's say like BLM, for example, I've always thought that you know, the social justice warrior, the woke, is basically Jewish ethno-narcissism projected onto other groups like minorities or homosexuals or whatever. It's kind of the Jewish mentality being put into these people's heads via Jewish media. But with a group like BLM, they've been told that they're the greatest victims, and that that everything is supposed to be about them. That you're the victim of white racism, and well, you actually built America, and well, they America owes you everything. And of course, this is transposed onto every other white country in its own way. But they couldn't care less about these narratives of Jewish suffering during World War II, because they're told themselves that they're the greatest victims. And when a Jew comes to them saying like, oh, well, you need to feel sorry for us, they just simply don't care, because they're the ones who believe that they deserve the sympathy.
Yeah, so, and they think that the Jews are white as well.
So. And they think that they're white. So it feels like it's this Frankenstein monster that Jewish activism has created, this pro-Palestinian movement, which is now kind of turning against it. Sorry, I was going on for a bit there. I'll let you respond.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, exactly. It's the kind of thing that you don't really know what to think about it, because did they think that this was a good idea, that it would work out as long as we never need their support? In some way that as long as they don't ever turn against us, and there's no reason that they would ever turn against us, then it's wise for us to encourage their proliferation in around the West. But it's odd that they now didn't predict that eventually there's going to be some sort of conflict in, you know, Gaza, in which case these people will turn against us. They didn't foresee that, and I don't really know why they didn't foresee that. Maybe they just didn't think about this. Maybe all they were thinking of was what will weaken white people.
I mean, that's what I feel that they weren't. The other thing you have to think about with them is that a lot of them are motivated by ethnic hatred. So, you know, it's a staple of literature and of drama and tragedy this kind of hatred, this spite and malice, usually ends up coming back to affect you yourself. So in many ways, their own ethnic hatred and their own desire to cause harm to Western civilization and people of European descent in many ways has come back to bite them, because now they're being called all the things that they've spent decades, all the horrible things that they've spent decades calling us. Now, I will also say that with the whole Israel-Palestine stuff, I don't think it's as big of a white pill as others, because there is another aspect to it that, when someone like Greenblatt talks about TikTok, or someone like Nikki Haley talks about TikTok, I mean, that's another incredible thing that Nikki Haley, who's, I think her real name is like Nimrata something, but anyway, that she comes out and then says that the entire platform must be banned because people use it to become anti-Semitic by watching it. I think she said like 30 minutes of TikTok makes you 17% more anti-Semitic. Where did you get that figure from? Why is it 17%? Why not 17.5%? How do you measure anti-Semitism by a percentage? Like, can you put it on a graph?
it's a preposterous thing to say.
It's ridiculous. But I don't mean to throw water over the fire, because there is a lot. I'll get to what the white pill of this is, but there is something else to consider that, and I've said this several times already. The people that Nimrata is scared about becoming anti-Semitic, most of them are not our friends. So the pro-Palestine movement, basically, is split into two camps. There's one which is the Islamic one, the Muslim camp, which they just want Islamic domination of the West rather than Jewish domination, and there's just as much an enemy as they're just as foreign and just as much an enemy of our civilization as the organized Jewish community has been over for the last couple of decades. So they're not our friends. I really hate when people try to stand up for to talk about how Islam is based or that Palestinians are based. They are not our allies in the least. And then there are white leftists and the people who congregate around that part around them. And their criticism of Israel is that it doesn't fully embrace the universalist egalitarian worldview, which, ironically, again, that the organized Jewish community has been prescribing for white countries. So they've fully imbibed. Okay, so the organized Jewish community pushed this universalist egalitarian and frankly anti-white ideology as a Machiavellian tool to break white ethnocentrism and transfer that power to their ethnic group. Whereas with white leftists, they've fully imbibed this kind of this ideology, and they simply want global homo to apply to Israel in addition to Western countries. So the divide between the whole Israel-Palestine thing, I mean, other than, so there's radical Islam, or just Islam in general, that wants to assert itself. There is the Zionism, which is basically pushing global homo for everyone except Israel. And then there are the white leftists who are basically saying global homo for everyone, including Israel. So it's important to know that none of these people are on our side. I don't stand with Palestine. I obviously think that Israel's operations there, military operations in Palestine are quite brutal. I'm not saying that I support that either, but we do not share a common cause with them. Despite what, some people with a now defunct political party might try to tell you on Telegram. But the white pill of all of this is that the anti-white coalition is actually a lot more fragile than it might have appeared earlier. So rather than us being up against this one big anti-white behemoth, it might actually be various factions who don't necessarily agree with each other. So that means that, like, so instead of being against this one massive, my analogy is, instead of being against one massive army, you're fighting against two smaller armies who also are fighting against each other. So it's an easier battle to win.
Yeah. This is a distinction that I was going to make earlier. My mind went blank, so I'm sorry about that. But it's the fact that, you say that international Jewish organizations have created this Frankenstein's creature that is now biting them. But you've got to distinguish between between liberal Jews who've got plans for the West, and the, you know, the, that means the Barbara Lynn are spectre types. That whole creed, where the West is going to be browned up, basically. And then you've got the Zionists. And now actually, Barbara Lynn are spectre is a bad example here because she's both. She both wants mixing in the West and nationalism in Israel. But with most Jews, it seems that it's one or the other, or at least there are a lot of Jews who are one or the other. So you'll get these liberal Jews in America who are anti-Zionist or ambivalent towards Israel, but they want maximum brownage in America. And then you've got the Zionists, and the Zionists are frequently anti-Islam. Now, so that's the counter-jihad types, who will preach about how awful Islam is and how anti-Semitic it is and how violent it is and how backward it is and how barbaric it is and how irrational and violent they are and so forth. And I used to wonder what the point was. Why are they doing that? Do they actually worry about the West? Do they have these Zionist anti-Islam Jews? Do they have concern for the West? Why is it that they're so... And now I think it's because they didn't want us allying with Muslims against Jewry.
Well, I think it's more because they wanted sympathy for Israel rather than that they didn't want us allying with Muslims. Because
that's a better way to phrase it. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Because I don't think us allying with Muslims is desirable or possible in any way. I think it's more that they want the West to continue to sympathize with Israel and continue to have foreign policy in favor of Israel. So they want to continue to have these wars in the Middle East, which serve Israel's geopolitical interests, and the white populations in the West to continue to sympathize, not just with Jews, but with the state of Israel in particular. So yes, there is this distinction between liberal Jews and right-wing Zionist Jews. However, I mean, for our purposes, I think that neither of them are on our side as well.
And the other thing is that there are a great number of Jews who are both. You know, that they're pro-Zionist, but they're also pro-big business, and they're pro-mass immigration, they're pro-brownage of the West. But they're not cultural sort of SJW-type progressives. It's a racial thing. They want Israel to be strong and the West to be weak. So that it's a mix, you know. Different Jews have different views.
but what you see is that, like, what's going on is there are a lot of divisions within what we would consider to be our enemies. So I think the positive that I took out of the whole Israel-Palestine stuff is that our enemies' coalition is not as tight as it could have been, and there are many cracks which will emerge in it. And that means it's easier to fight several different smaller enemies who are not unified with each other than one big one. But then also the fact that this is kind of like what we were talking about with the ADL, along with Israel, just the organized Jewish community has just lost a lot of prestige. Their prestige has declined quite significantly this year, and I don't see an end to that. You know, one point that has been brought up a few times, and I know I've heard you discuss it, the sanctity of the Holocaust seems to be wearing off. So the idea that we must always support the state of Israel, we must never allow anti-Semitism, and by extension the white ethnocentrism which causes that to ever arise again, and you know, this is the greatest crime in history, and we must I feel that that's waning now. There are a few reasons. I mean, one of them that I know a lot of people have mentioned is that it's the amount of time that has passed since World War II. And now that one I'm kind of torn on, because it does seem like people are talking about slavery more than they ever have. And slavery was 80 years before the Holocaust in World War II. So I don't know if that's necessarily the cause, but it definitely Well, you basically see the their ability to use that as this to use that as a weapon against us, to use that as this as this weapon for moral blackmail. That really is starting to wane, I think. I think maybe another reason. I think another reason for that is that a lot of younger people are non-white, and that they just don't have that. Again, like I mentioned earlier, they've been told that they're the ones who are the victims, and that they're the ones who deserve sympathy. Then it shouldn't be them giving sympathy out.
Yeah, I mean, people are ultimately selfish, and if you tell some brown kid you're a victim, then he's going to lap that up. If you tell him, and these Jews are victims because of the Holocaust, it's not really any interest.
And they're bigger victims than you because of this. And then he's going to say, "Hell no, I'm the victim. I'm the one who deserves all the sympathy and the gibes."
exactly.
What else was I going to say? I also just thought of the media that's been produced in recent decades. So. Boomers and Gen X, they had things like Schindler's List. Now that came out a couple years before I was born, but I remember this stuff being really big in the media throughout the 2000s. There were lots of movies like that, like The Pianist or Life is Beautiful or all, this kind of stuff. But in the past decade, though, I feel that that's like shifted a bit, that now the biggest pieces of anti-white propaganda I remember from my adult life have been things like Django Unchained, 12 Years a Slave, The Hateful Eight, Get Out. It seems like the narrative has kind of been shifted away from, like, it seems that Jews have kind of been decentered from that, and blacks have been put in place.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think that they could just keep producing Holocaust films and people would keep lapping it up. And lapping up the guilt.
Well, they still do produce them, but they just don't seem to be hitting as hard as they used to.
For some reason, it's just not landing. I mean, like with the black slave stuff, the Django Unchained and all that, blacks lap that up because they want to believe that they're victims and they want to be angry at whitey and so on.
Yeah, I maintain that that's probably the most anti-white movie ever made. Like, I remember...
I've not seen it. Don't.
Like, I even remember in high school that, people would watch that, and then they would become more anti-white after watching that movie. That was just around the time of the whole Trayvon Martin, the first wave of BLM. It was just before that. I absolutely despise that movie. I feel that that was, that was for this wave of anti-whiteism what Schindler's List was for the previous one. The only difference is that, with the Schindler's List, the message is pushing is like, you should feel terrible and you should feel guilty. Whereas the message of Django Unchained, I think it's actually directed to non-whites, saying, you should want revenge on white people, and you should basically go out and kill them.
And they're still pushing this now. I mean, there's this thing I was just reading about today, the Magical Negro film, and there's another one that I think was actually produced by the Obamas, where some black guy says that you should be afraid of white people or something, or what's the most frightening animal in the world or something, something like that. So they're still very much pushing this. But again, I think to some extent, it's black people are actually doing it themselves, maybe. I don't know. But either way, it is still there, and it is still very much getting an audience. It's very much in keeping with the whole woke thing.
White people
are just awful, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
Nothing to do with the Holocaust, that's the thing.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it seems to be, because all the Holocaust movies, like, they seem to be targeted either at a Jewish audience who want to tell themselves how great victims they are and how great their people are, or a white audience who are supposed to feel sympathy, who are supposed to feel guilty. That's the purpose, I find, of a lot of the Holocaust movies. But I find that the more recent propaganda, it seems to be increasingly so directed at a non-white audience and designed to inculcate hatred in them. So rather than inculcate guilt in a white audience, it seems like something like Django Unchained or the Hateful Eight or whatever trash they're making today, is aimed at the increasing demographic of non-whites in the West and telling them, well, you should hate white people. And
isn't Whitey a piece of shit? And shouldn't you want to get the better of him, to get revenge on him, etc.? Seeding this racial hatred. With regard to Holocaust films, I didn't actually know that they are still making any. I haven't heard of any for years, but then I don't really follow Hollywood very closely. But I think maybe another reason why it's not popular anymore is just that it's so boring now. It's such a cliche. I mean, everyone's seen this stuff. Everyone knows about the striped pajamas, the watchtower, the gas chambers, the lines of emaciated people, all the cliches. It's so there and exhaustively talked about and meditated over that maybe people are just bored to death with it. I really don't know what the answer is, but for one reason or another, it seems to have just fallen away. And I'm genuinely, maybe this will be one of those eternal questions. It's just never really answered, never really clarified. Why did the millennials care about it less than the boomers and Gen X? Gen X care about it less than the boomers. Millennials care about it less than Gen X, and Zoomers care about it less than millennials. But it might just be the obvious answer there would be, okay, well, it's time passing. It's just the temporal proximity to the event is getting, it's just greater and greater. So people just cannot care about it. They cannot take it seriously anymore.
The other issue is now this one's maybe not quite as optimistic, but it's just the spread of general nihilism. Because, and again, going back to what I was saying earlier, the organized Jewish community has played a huge part in this as well, because they've spent decades spreading nihilism in Western countries and saying that, well, why would you be a racist? Well, everyone is the same. Well, why does one, what do borders matter? Borders are just arbitrary lines on a map. And why do you care so much about why don't you just go listen to rock and roll and smoke pot? And not that I'm totally against smoking pot, but not that I'm against rock and roll. I do like rock and roll. But the point is, it's like spreading this kind of nihilism. This is the nihilism that's spread that they've spent a long time spreading. But then when it's, but the Holocaust, well, that's a sacred event and we must never forget. And this is the most horrible occurrence in human history. And we must never forget that the Jewish proverb that to save one life is to save all mankind. But if you're going to spread this nihilism throughout the media for decades, people are going to then apply that same nihilism to the thing that you're trying to make them sincere about. Because with the boomers, like the boomers are not nearly as nihilistic as the following generations, because there actually still is perhaps a naive optimism, but there is still an optimism there. Like when you hear boomers talk about their country, maybe they'll say things like, well, oh, it's great because of our constitution, or it's great because of, well, of our freedoms, or because maybe it's even because of our democracy, or maybe they might even say because
of the Nazis.
Or something like that, yeah. In Canada, unfortunately, people might even say because of our diversity, but that's becoming increasing. But the point is that when a boomer says something like that, there is a sincerity there, though. I mean, obviously, I disagree with that, that's what makes Western countries great. But let's look at the most recent one, the Zoomers. There's none of that. Like they don't believe any of this because they've just been raised on nihilism. Like with a Zoomer, they can't ever take anything seriously. Absolutely everything is ironic for them. Have you ever noticed that?
It's actually quite tiresome for someone who doesn't get into that humor. It's like, for fuck's sake. Yeah, I know you're really clever. I know you don't take anything seriously, very sophisticated. You know, it's kind of annoying.
Oh yeah, I can't stand it either. But again, that's a problem in of itself. But in terms of in terms of Holocaustianity, well, that's another reason for its decline, is that nobody can take anything seriously anymore, and as a result, well, they're not gonna take the things that the same people who have been pushing nihilism. If you spend 75 years pushing nihilism, don't be surprised when people can't be bothered to care about the thing you actually think they should be sincere about. But anyway, I think we've covered that issue. There are a few other things that we also that I also thought were positive from this year.
Absolutely. But before we get into that, we should also, because it's about the Gaza conflict, and it's also disgraced Zionists and their supporters,
yes,
in the West. So that's another aspect that we should maybe go into.
Well, yeah, actually, that was exactly the thing I wanted to transition onto. So, you know, other than, so we've covered the organized Jewish community themselves, but there's also, by extension, those who are their supporters, and well, to be a bit more frank, their shills. So there are people like Jordan Peterson, people like Douglas Murray. If you had to ask me who was more disgusting of the two, I'd have a very hard time giving you that answer. I feel that these people,
Douglas Murray isn't mentally ill, so therefore he has to be the more disgusting, I would say.
Yeah, but like again with Douglas Murray, he goes to Israel to report on the conflict, and while he's telling people in Britain that they should have a rally against the pro-Palestine movement, he tells them like, "Oh, we need to rally for our for Remembrance Day and for our ancestors who fought the Nazis and stop these anti-Semites in London." While he's getting themselves arrested, and while he's going off to Israel to basically shill for them. And did you see that video where Douglas Murray pretended to see a rocket flying overhead?
Yeah, I did. Horrible.
Yeah. And I mean, to bring this back to some of another article I wrote earlier this year, I wrote an article which I made it into a video, which I actually had a lot of fun with. It was called "When Robespierre Posted Cringe." And I told the story of the fall of Maximilian Robespierre during the French Revolution, and this event that he held for his new revolutionary religion that he tried to create. He tried to create like this new religion to replace Christianity, and he held this festival for it. But it failed miserably, and it was really just cringe, and it made him a laughingstock among his contemporaries. And the point I wanted, I looked at a few other political movements that have kind of gone through something similar, like the new atheism movement with the whole the quote of "at this moment I am euphoric," and like I tried to look at like when political movements jump the shark, so to say. I feel that with Zionism, I might eventually write a follow up article titled "When Zionism Posted Cringe," because you look at all of this the propaganda that they're trying to release now to back up their narratives about Israel and the Israel-Palestine conflict. All of this is cringe. I'm going to get back into the, I know we wanted to move on from this issue, but the Israeli,
talk about this aspect of it.
Well, like there's the Israeli ambassadors wearing the Stars of David at the UN. There was the former Prime Minister Bennett, I forget what show it on, some British show. He had an outburst screaming about Nazis on British TV, made a complete fool of himself. There's Ben Shapiro talking about the beheaded babies and basically going on Twitter calling for genocide of Palestinians. And all of this is really cringe. It does seem like kind of a jumping the shark moment for Zionism, really. And another part of that, no, Douglas Murray isn't himself Jewish, but he's bought and paid for by them.
It's worse. He's a Shabbos guy. He's willingly bought and unsold, as it were.
But like that video of him pretending that there's a rocket flying overhead. Like, I mean, all I can say is I definitely
we know for sure that there wasn't a rocket?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, but all I can say is that he certainly didn't attend acting school. He's certainly not going to win any Oscars. First of all, because he can't act. Secondly, because he's white. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. Well, at least he's gay.
Well, then, who knows? Maybe he's back in the running for that. And if he's doing it to shill for Israel, then who knows? Maybe he actually will get a mention.
What gets me about him is how shameless he is and how committed he is. He seems to be, and this gets to the point that that you noted in your notes, that the discrediting of these people. Jordan Peterson obviously made a complete fool of himself. And was, you know, bloodthirsty. I mean, it's just absurd. And I'm not even saying that war is always unjust or terrible, or that we should be squeamish. I understand the realities of things. But why does he care that much about Jews? I mean, why is he saying to Netanyahu to give him hell? Why is he so invested? Especially when he, this is Jordan Peterson I'm talking about, is so... well, he's preaching individualism for us. So fuck him. I mean, this is just, it's disgusting. He should be ashamed. He's a pathetic man. He really is a weak, weak man.
He's such a disgrace. Yeah.
But then you've got Douglas Murray, who, as I say, he's not, at least Peterson has the excuse that he's mentally ill. You know, so you can it sort of mitigates to some extent. Douglas Murray doesn't have that defense, and you could almost see him as some kind of psychopath who is just doing whatever is best for him and his career and his wallet.
I mean,
regardless of how many lives it costs, I mean, it's just absolutely, it's beyond shameful.
Yeah, I mean, the worst thing about him is that, now I'm not going to try to imitate it because I know there are people who could probably do it a lot better than me, but like that slow and dramatic way he has of speaking about how Jews in Britain don't feel safe, that they go outside and they worry that they're going to be attacked in the street, and that this reminds them of the 1930s. And it's like, oh, for crying out loud.
Yes. Yeah, who's bringing them here? I mean, and they've got a place they can go. So what's the problem? I mean, if it's really this bad here, then they can just leave. It's not some terminal problem. But of course, his livelihood depends on it being a serious problem. So we've got to change everything. Now, the thing is, I agree with what you're saying about this way of speaking, which is extremely self-righteous. It's extremely moralistic. And dramatic as well. And I mean, it's like he went to acting school, but, you know, maybe failed. But he is very over the top, is what I'm saying. And it's nauseating to hear this, especially now, you know, at least when he was being self-righteous about, you know, the Muslim rape gangs in Britain, you can understand. But when he's being self-righteous about the Palestinians, in what's going on in Gaza, and being completely, dismissive of the suffering imposed on them by the Israelis, that sheds an entirely new light on it. You know, that makes his moralism and his dramatic way of delivering just seem absolutely fake. Fake. And evil.
Well, I mean, and it's also clear that with Douglas Murray, you know, he wrote this book, which I haven't read, by the way. He wrote this book, The Strange Death of Europe. I mean, that's not strange.
It's not strange at all.
It's not strange when you actually bother to try to understand it.
Imagine when you write a book and even the title is a lie. Well, imagine being that dishonest.
Well, I mean, to give him credit, I mean, he's right about the death of Europe. But the only thing he's not right about is it being strange. But what's fascinating about him is, like, if you wrote a book, The Death of Europe, or The Strange Death of Europe, as he put it, that's a pretty dramatic title. The death of the continent which birthed Western civilization, which conquered the world and brought humanity basically all the like 90% of its advancements. That's a pretty dramatic thing, but clearly to Douglas Murray, there is something that is more important than the death of Europe. And he is absolutely adamant that you do not find out what is causing the strange death of the not so strange death of Europe. Once you actually look into it. Now, I mean, I do think there is more. I think there is more to it. I don't want to be too simplistic. I do think that,
of course, we all know
there is
in a bad way already.
Yeah,
and of course,
yeah. Well, there's that, and then there's also. I mean, I don't want to be. I don't want to be too simplistic because as we've been talking about for the last hour or so, the organized Jewish community has had played a huge hand in this. However, that doesn't mean that there weren't white elites who also are also responsible for what's going on. The death of Europe, I guess you could say, or at least the trends that are kind of putting things on that pathway. So I don't want to be too simplistic and say that that's entirely the issue. But the problem is that this is part of the issue. And if that was actually the most important thing to you, the death of your continent, of your civilization, I mean, clearly that should be the priority and shilling for a foreign group over in the Middle East. But I think, though, that with these types, counter-jihad, what used to be called alt-light types, I feel that they've also really been discredited a lot as well, because and credit to like all of the listeners, all of the subscribers out there who have Twitter accounts with 15 followers and no avatar or something like that, or credit to all of them or people in the YouTube comments and whatever. But anytime they post something like this, they are going to get absolutely lambasted by our guys in the comment sections, basically telling the truth. So I don't feel that their deception is really holding on. It's not really holding weight. And kind of like what we talked about at the beginning, the fact that this particular issue is now being discussed more widely than it ever has, that goes to show that things are being pushed in a direction in the correct direction. Who knows? Maybe that's why people like Douglas Murray and even Tommy Robinson are now seemingly being resurrected from the dead. Jordan Peterson as well. Remember that fiasco in London, which I think that was, I think you and I were both on the Countercurrent stream about that. I feel that stuff kind of just clangs now. Now Tommy Robinson, unfortunately, he still has a group of idiot followers who I got into a few arguments with on Twitter back when that happened. But it does feel that kind of controlled opposition, counter jihad, the pressure release valve that's supposed to give you some of the answers but prevent you from really seeing the full truth, I feel that is also really lost. This has been in the making for a couple of years now, and it didn't just happen this year, but I feel that a lot of that has lost credibility as well.
Absolutely, and that was what I was going to bring in next, that I think it's just run its course. Tommy Robinson, that should, and I think the media actually tried to make that quite a big deal, quite a big story. And it's we did talk about it. We did take the bait in to that extent, but it just didn't become big. He was back on Twitter. No one ever. When was that? Like, that must have been that's more than a month ago.
Month and a half ago.
Yes, like 5 weeks ago. And I haven't heard anything about. I think I heard him mentioned once with regard. Ah, yeah, that was it. He was arrested on a subsequent protest, and that's it. That's the only time I've heard of him. In these 5 weeks,
and he was and then the Jewish community of London was cheered it on when their own show was arrested.
Yeah,
crazy.
Which in turn makes you think, what the hell is going on here? Even their own even they, like, it's like they don't quite get it either. They don't. It's like the memo wasn't delivered to them that they're supposed to support him because he's supporting them.
Well, it only ever goes one way with them. I remember Netanyahu even threw Trump under the bus despite Trump kowtowing to them for 4 years. But another point I wanted to bring up was, and this is kind of related to that ridiculous brouhaha in London, which was orchestrated by Tommy Robinson. Which, unfortunately, I mean, the real crime of that was that dozens of people got arrested at this protest. I made a post on social media back when that happened, is that it feels like everything with Tommy Robinson is PR. It's all like a PR spin that he's just like wheeled around so that a photo can be taken of him in a certain location. And then the left can say, oh no, far right racist Tommy Robinson. And then the Zionist controlled opposition right can say, working class hero Tommy Robinson. And the guy's living, I've heard he's living in like a Spanish island or something like that on the beach.
I don't know.
He's like a millionaire, and yet he's being wheeled around like he's like a football lad from, I don't know, Liverpool.
Yeah, it's absurd. I don't know where he's living, and I don't want to say anything that's untrue, but apparently his clothing is like very expensive, you know, designer labels and all that.
Yeah.
He's not... I mean, look at that. It's almost like Darth. Remember that line in Star Wars? And I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, but there's that line. It's like he's more machine than man now.
It does feel that way. Like it doesn't feel. Like, everything with him just feels like it's PR. It just feels like it just feels all so fake and gay. Exactly. And that's why it just rubs me so the wrong way so much. And then afterwards, I proceeded to block him on Twitter because I had forgotten that the guy existed, and I decided to go back to having forgotten that he existed. But part of Tommy Robinson is to what we were talking about earlier is to shill for the Zionist lobby. But then the other aspect of Tommy Robinson is that he is meant to play the role of the far-right racist neo-fascist, which we obviously know. Hey, if he actually were as things, he might be kind of based, but clearly he isn't. You know, to kneecap the right. I had forgotten all about this, but apparently what Pax Populi was saying was that he actually turned up in those... at the protests in Ireland from, I think it was either the beginning of this year or the end of last year. I can't remember. But when they were having these protests against these refugee centers being put up in Ireland, Tommy Robinson turns up in Ireland. And then there's this brown guy there who says that, oh, Tommy, I'm such a fan of yours. And then Tommy like proceeds to say, oh, it's not about race. It's about Islam. And, you know, horrible. But so the other side of Tommy Robinson is that he's kind of the media's boogeyman. So Hope Not Hate, the British version of the ADL, kind of has this symbiotic relationship with him, that he complains about them, they complain about him, and then it's just this kind of like clown show where it's all fake. Not saying that that Hope Not Hate is fake, but it's a very real threat. But it feels like Tommy Robinson is kind of their boogeyman that they can constantly point to. I do feel that another positive that I've noticed this year is that a lot of the fear mongering about the far right, I feel that that's really kind of died off, because we can contrast a few things that have gone on in the past year or so to similar events from the previous couple of years and see that they've really not been able to spin these nearly as effectively as they had. So that fiasco in London, that was a flash in the pan. Now, I mean, the worst thing about that is the naive followers who fell into the trap and got arrested because of Tommy Robinson. But it seemed, and that it was reported. So even in Canada, they were reporting on this event. But it was just a one day thing. Whereas if you contrast that with something like January 6th or Charlottesville, these were absolutely media. these were, what's the correct word? They were massive news stories. These were massive news stories. They were media shitstorms for weeks and weeks, months and months. The ground that was gained by the establishment because of Charlottesville and because of January 6th, like the narrative that the most dangerous thing in the country is far right racists, and we need more censorship, and we need to crack down on these people, and they're around every corner, and they're the problem with America, and this is our, or whatever country you're in, and this is our history of white supremacy. And that didn't really seem to happen with the whole London fiasco. That seemed to just kind of be a flash in the pan. And I imagine that now I do think that thing was kind of more planned than something like Charlottesville was. I think Charlottesville, the authorities allowed it to happen because they knew that they knew what they could do with it. But the organizers themselves, I don't think they were feds. I think they were just really naive, and it was really just an ill-conceived event. Whereas something like the Tommy Robinson thing from London, that was clearly planned by the people from within the establishment, or at least adjacent to it. But they didn't gain nearly as much ground off of that. Another incident. Now this, I think a lot of people will have forgotten about this. And to be honest, I can't even remember exactly where or when this happened, but there was this mass shooting in the United States this year. I think maybe two or three people were killed and about 10 or so were injured. And I think it was a white guy who said that he hated black people, and he went and murdered some and then shot himself. Now I need to be clear that I unilaterally condemn such actions. I'm totally against illegality and violence of this kind. So I need to make that clear. And I know the same goes for Woes as well. He would make the same condemnation of such acts. But if you contrast that with the Charlotte, North Carolina, was it the Dylan Roof shooting? Dylan Roof shooting from 2015, or I think it was, which was very similar to this one. I think that one might have had a few more victims, but I know there was another one in Buffalo, I think the year prior, which had more victims than the Dylan Roof one. But none of these were turned into these media fiascos the same way that that the Dylan Roof shooting turned out to be. And because I remember back in 2015, so much they gained so much ground off of that. Like, so the entire thing about this is America's history of white supremacism, and this resulted in the Confederate battle flag being removed from the state flags of several southern states. I remember that there was that John Stewart, who we mentioned earlier, had this big spiel about how this is America's white supremacist history coming back to bite us. And every day a black man must drive by statues of Confederate generals who fought to keep his ancestors enslaved and see that Confederate flag on the flagpost. And I remember this being talked about for months and months back then, but when something similar happened, recently, and again, I totally condemn the actions of these individuals, but the ability of the regime to actually use one of these events to gain political ground, it really seems to be diminishing. So I feel that they've kind of used up the white supremacist far right neo-Nazi boogeyman.
I think it's like the Holocaust. It's like they've saturated people with it. It's over the top. People are sick of it, and it's just boring now. It's like when you've heard the same song over and over again, it's just mind-numbing.
So yeah, like even taking certain events that some of them may have been planned, but then the other ones, which were the actual result of some madman going out and committing a crime, in recent years, they had been able to absolutely create these storms in the media over that and just gin the public up into this hysteria over the far right and over white supremacy and all this stuff. But that seems to be disappearing as well. I just feel that that people are not as afraid of they don't take that boogeyman as seriously as they used to. And by extension, the other positive thing is that the talking point of the Great Replacement is now pretty much going mainstream. Because I remember a couple of years ago when this was called a, in fact, it still is called a conspiracy theory. It's called this white supremacist conspiracy theory with no basis in reality. But now, and now I know that again, this what's his name, Vivek Ramaswamy, the Indian guy that's running for the GOP candidacy. He mentioned this in a recent debate. Now, again, I'm not saying that this guy's our guy, or I'm not saying that he's going to reverse any of it. I'm not saying he's going to be the one to stop the Great Replacement. But what this shows is that somebody who's running for president on who's running for the GOP ticket, he actually has to say this now, because this is a very serious issue, which those who would be voting for the GOP in the United States, they're very aware of it. So even though I don't think that this guy is sincere in I don't think he's actually sincere about this, the fact that he now has to say this is it's a sign of massive progress, because that would have been unimaginable even in the 2020 election. I couldn't imagine Donald Trump in 2020 saying that the Great Replacement is Democrat policy. Now, you know, that's only partly true.
But yeah, and also notice that he's not only said it, but it hasn't destroyed him to say it.
Exactly, yeah.
That's important. It's like these other things that have happened, because you could say, but it's just a flash in the pan. And maybe he won't ever say anything like that again. But what's happened here is that other people will have seen that he said it, and it didn't destroy his career. So this kind of thing matters, because it will embolden. The left have always known this. Every little helps. And it will embolden other people to say similar and even stronger things in the future.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not a flash in the pan, because, it's just a one-off comment. But this is now being, again, discussed much more openly than it ever has been before. Because, you know, I think I first heard the phrase Great Replacement in maybe 2017, I'd say. Maybe 2016, 2017, that was when I first heard the phrase. But, I mean, the reality is that that's been going on, you could argue, since 1945. It's been going on since 1945, maybe the 1960s in the case of Canada and the United States. But and then since the 1990s, it's been like in the 1990s, it was absolutely turned up to 11. So non-white immigration, I know that in Britain, it started with the Empire Windrush in the 1940s. The policies of Canada and the United States, before the 1960s, they had white-only immigration policies. That changed in the U.S. in 1965, in Canada in 67, and I think in Australia in 1970. So these, those policies were changed decades ago. And then in the 1990s, in Britain, Canada, I believe the United States as well, immigration numbers were exponentially increased. So the numbers were, it was kind of just a trickle before that. But then in the 1990s, it was increased massively. So my point is that this has been going on for at least the last 30 years or the last 60 years, or maybe you could even say since the end of World War II. But it has never been, this kind of issue has never been discussed so openly.
It's never been framed in that way. It's never been said in that way. And the question is, what is this going to lead to? Because the establishment, by which I mean the whole political and media, they can't acknowledge that. It's going to be a very difficult thing for them to deal with, to address in any way, because they have to acknowledge their own part in it. And also, there's nothing that can be done about it that's pretty. You know, you're talking about mass deportation, mass repatriation, or just accept it, even though it's bad, or it's great. Vivek said it, and yes, it's happening, and yes, it's real, and yes, it's actually tremendous. So, of course, we should do nothing about it.
I feel that's the line they're going to go with. I mean, hey, if they actually were serious about stopping it, I mean, at the very least, they could just stop immigration. I mean, that's certainly, that wouldn't fix the demographic crisis, but at least it would stop the bleeding. But of course, you know, they're not going to do that. I feel that what the way they're going to go with it is they're going to say, oh yeah, it's happening, but it's a good thing. Because I mean, they already are saying that. They already do say that.
But one counter to that is, but it's not a good thing because it endangers the Jews.
Oh God. Yeah.
Which is actually the truth, oddly enough.
Funny, yeah, it kind of it goes back to what I was saying earlier with Dr. Goldenstein's monster, that, you know, in many ways they've kind of done it to themselves. However, I mean, I wouldn't call that necessarily a victory for us, because ultimately our goal is to save our countries, and if our countries turn into shit,
being facetious. But it is something that actually, well, that could be said, and actually is being said. I mean, even Douglas Murray, you know, you and I have blackballed him here in this stream, but he has said this, that we can't live with these people. We can't live with people who hate Jews. And he's referring to Muslims. The Muslims who are anti-Semitic. So that, I mean, again, if the establishment is going to take that seriously, along with the white replacement stuff, they're going to be in a difficult position. So I don't know maybe they'll just have to try to ignore it. What else can they do? They just bury it, just ignore it, mock it, mock the person saying it, attack him, deplatform him, etc. But again, I don't think that's working. So I don't know what's going to happen here, but I think it's going to be, there's going to be conflict. And I don't mean violence. I mean, it's going to be a difficult next 5 years as this is acknowledged, and they can't altogether just say, but the white replacement's happening, but it's great. They can't say that, because that conflicts with the facts on the ground that everyone knows, but also the Jewish thing as well. But it does make our countries more anti-Semitic. It just does.
I think that the positive of this is, because we also have to remember that the ruling elite is not unified entirely. And this goes back to the Elon Musk issue. When these issues are being discussed, this like kind of, the other thing, or like Musk saying that on Twitter, that somebody that Jews pushing anti-whitism, that's the actual truth. I know he kind of like backtracked on that a little, but nonetheless, he hasn't kowtowed to them. They haven't been able to bring him to heel yet. But nonetheless, the fact that these issues are being discussed on a level that they haven't been before, that gives people within the ruling class the ability to the permission in many ways to actually start to consider things like this. So, who knows? I mean, you know, I think that. The winning scenario would be that people within the ruling class do begin to take a lot of the issues that you and I have been talking about for several years seriously. So, I don't think that it's going to necessarily be that our movement, so to say, is going to, you know, seize the reins of control. I think what would be more likely would be that people within the ruling class would imbibe some of the ideas that we.
Yeah, that would be the ideal. That's what we've got to hope for, is that some brave faction emerges within the elite who say, listen, the alt-right, the dissident right, they've been correct all along, and sooner or later we're going to have to admit it. And it's actually better if we do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think that that would be probably the more realistic scenario that actual political progress for us. There are rumblings of that actually, of something along the lines of that actually happening. Maybe not to say the alt-right were right all along, but the idea that, well, things simply cannot go in this direction. This is maybe they'll do what
Sargon did, and they'll continue demonizing us while aping our talking points.
Well, you know what? Sargon's an internet personality, but if governments actually start doing that and implementing our policies, hey, they can call me white supremacist, neo-Nazi, far-right racist, all they want. Just if you change the policies to the ones I want, I'll take it.
Yeah.
There's something that I think that kind of flew under the radar on our sphere, but I think this might actually be the most positive thing for us this year, maybe next to the Twitter thing, but this thing is also extremely positive. A lot of investment companies have dropped ESG from their criteria. So a lot of investors now are no longer using ESG to determine which companies they should invest in or not. If anyone doesn't know what ESG stands for, is environmental environmental, social, and corporate governance. And what ESG basically is, it's in effect a social credit system for companies, for corporations, which they're given a score based on, in effect, how woke they are. So it involves things like diversity. It involves things like how many women they have on their boards, how much they contribute to social justice causes and stuff like that, like LGBT, how much LGBT funding they give to charities or whatever. And then it's also involved with a bunch of climate change stuff as well. So their carbon emissions and all that nonsense. But this was a system that was designed to tell people that was used by investors who are ideologically motivated to tell them which companies they should be giving the money to and which companies they shouldn't. And companies would try to be what's called ESG competent by being more woke because they need to get their ESG scores up. There's been this major backlash against ESG within the corporate world this past year because it doesn't align with economic realities, because it goes without saying that hiring people who are incompetent because they're mixed race lesbians with mental illnesses doesn't actually make your company more profitable. Same with, and that also goes with the climate change stuff, that also is, it's making it, it would make it extremely difficult for, it would make it extremely difficult for companies to actually be profitable. So, within the corporate world, what a lot of people are saying now is that we just can't do this. We cannot run our companies based on this ludicrous rating system, because it simply does not line up with economic realities. And a lot of investment firms have dropped ESG as part of their criteria for investment. Even Larry Fink, the leader of BlackRock, its Jewish CEO, he's all in favor of ESG. He's as anti-white as you'd imagine. But even he said he would stop using the word ESG because it's gained bad reputation. So even within elite circles, there are rumblings that people thinking, hold on, how are we going to actually run things? How are we actually going to be profitable? If we're basing policies on these absolutely ludicrous ideas? So there are actual rumblings, like from within the elite, that people might actually think that things are not going in the right direction. I wrote an article recently titled "The Mother of All Sunk Cost Fallacies." Do you know what the sunk cost fallacy is, Woz?
Yeah, it's when you've invested a lot in something, so you don't want to give it up on it because that would mean all your efforts had been wasted.
Exactly. Yeah. So, say like you invest $30,000 in a business, and you feel like you have to stay in business so you don't let your $30,000 go to waste. The problem is, if your business is not successful, you're going to just end up wasting even more money than that. When if you don't have a chance of being profitable, the correct decision would be to go out of business, because all that staying in business longer would do is it would lose you more money. So I wrote this article kind of inspired by this simple concept in economics. And I want to apply it to the direction that Western civilization is going in. You'd have to think with a lot of these people, because I don't know if they're entirely motivated by some Machiavellian scheme that they have planned out meticulously. I know that they certainly have agendas, and I know that things have been planned, but is it actually motivated by something realistic, or is it, or was the plan actually that well thought out? Some people accuse me of saying that it was all a mistake rather than it being planned. That's not what I'm saying. I think it was planned. I'm just saying the plan was not very well thought out. What a lot of people in the elite would have to consider is, do they actually want to further pursue this these trends which we've been on since the end of the Second World War? How much further do they really want to pursue that if it results in the destruction of the society which awards them the clout that they have? So if you're a billionaire, regardless of whatever your ideology is, if you want to fly around the world on a private jet eating Wagyu beef and caviar, there actually has to be a semblance of a functional society to make that possible. There actually has to be a pilot who's able to fly the plane. There has to be an aircraft industry to manufacture the plane. There has to be a farming industry to harvest these luxury foods. There has to be a supply chain to get them to you. There has to be an airport that you're able to land the plane at. And all of that stuff is reliant on competency. There's that great article from earlier this year, Complex Systems Won't Survive the Competency Crisis. And in order to actually have that kind of lifestyle that the elite are accustomed to, they actually do need to have competency. And ironically, many of them hate Western civilization and want to destroy it, but their own status really relies on its continued prominence. A lot of them would have to ask themselves, do they actually want to continue to, like, I mean, the way I put it is, do you want to give up your private jet, your Wagyu beef and your caviar so that you can worship black transsexuals instead? I think for a lot of billionaires, the answer would be no. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of sociopaths within the elite for whom they will pursue such a policy, even if it results in their own destruction, because either they're just delusional utopians, or they are just so overcome with malice and hatred of our civilization that they would pursue that. But I don't think that all of them would. And Elon Musk is a good example of someone who he's not a true believer in wokeism. He's not a true believer in the egalitarian universalist creed of that the West embraced in the years following the Second World War. And what Elon Musk's ambition is to colonize Mars. He wants to go to Mars. He wants humanity to become a multi-planet species, as he put it. Well, if he actually wants that, he's going to need the civilization which brought us to space to begin with. I know Morgoth made a great video about it about a year and a half ago, that if Elon Musk actually wants to go to Mars, well, that's reliant on Western civilization, the Faustian civilization which brought us to the moon. And for anyone who says that we didn't go to the moon, fuck you. Sorry for the curse word, but I just had to put that in there. But nonetheless, if Musk actually wants to follow through with these ambitions, well, then he'd have to take these issues seriously. He'd actually have to think, well, you know, we're going to need some semblance of a competent society and a sane society, if that's even going to happen. I mean, another thing he said is that birth rates within the developed world, i.e. the white world, and maybe you include East Asia in that as well, that unless that rises to a replacement level, then colonizing the Mars is not going to happen. So someone like Musk would actually have to take a lot of these ideas seriously if he actually wants to follow through with his own ambitions. And I feel that that's a question that a lot of the elite will have to ask themselves in the coming years.
It makes you think, what the hell is going on? And why is Elon Musk the only one who you can plausibly imagine having these concerns? Why aren't the rest of the elite worried that our national IQs are dropping, that we no longer have any culture of excellence? I remember that I read a quote the other day. I think it was from Joe Sobran, and he said, "We went from, in the space of 100 years, we went from teaching Latin and Greek in high school to teaching remedial English at university." Why? And it's true. And so that's a very, very nice encapsulation of decline, which is very real. Everyone can see it. I think everyone can see that people are less articulate than they were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, etc. So, why aren't the elite concerned about this? I guess they think that, well, within our private schools, our international business schools and whatever, the standards remain high, so it's okay. Within our gated community, the standards remain high, so it's okay. And also maybe they have some sort of faith in technology to, you know, replace human brains with AI. So we won't need to be that smart anymore. Although that seems unlikely. I don't think that many people would willingly place their faith in such a thing, except for some complete sperg. Most normal people would not want to think it's fine if we're dysgenic. It's fine if we're all fucking thick in the future. No, who the hell would say that? So it makes you think, what are they thinking? And I think it is that they think, well, we'll be fine. The masses are going to get dumber, but we'll be okay. And I think that is incorrect. I think that you can see decline is like a weed. It's like a parasite. You've got to root it out everywhere in your society, because wherever it is able to take root, it will proliferate and spread. And eventually their gated communities and eventually their international business schools and their private schools will decline, and probably almost certainly are already visibly declining. I mean, who is well educated these days in the sense that we used to understand that, you know, 100 years ago? Almost nobody. So decline is everywhere. I don't think that anyone is safe from it. Anyone is, any sector of society is immune from it, even at the highest levels. So it's very naive of them to think that they will be okay, that they'll be safe from it. Well, everyone should be concerned with this.
It's not even just...
And just to close, I think that the only person in the elite who, as I say, you could believe is concerned with this is Elon Musk. The rest of them seem to be out to lunch.
Yeah, that's the way it appears, although it could be the case that they were concerned about this stuff, but they just were they knew that their status within the elite requires them to ignore it. I mean, perhaps a bit optimistic on my part, but what I hope happens is that with Musk actually coming out and talking about this stuff, because he is the elite of the elite, he's the richest man in the world, with him actually coming out and talking about this stuff, I hope that emboldens other members of the elite to actually start to consider these things. So, you know, if he is making it known that he holds these concerns, then it kind of gives a lot more. It gives the ability to express these concerns. It gives the other members of the elite a greater ability to express these concerns. And then, like, it's also important to note that not only do they want to maintain this stuff, I know that this has kind of gone out of fashion in our sphere, but didn't they want to have the Great Reset? Weren't they going to have this technocratic society with everything being run by AI and with digital IDs and self-driving cars? And, well, I mean, maintaining the current standards, that's one thing, but pulling off this massively ambitious project to make our society much more heavily reliant on technology, that's even more difficult when your average IQ is declining. So I just feel that if they actually want any of these technocratic stuff,
you can just imagine it. You know, like some robot is trying to clean the street, and the people are too stupid to appreciate that the street should be clean, so they just vandalize the robot. So then, I mean, that's what it would be like. So you have to have a police state to stop them from doing that. I mean, maybe that is the idea. I don't know.
Yeah, actually, some things like that have happened, though. Like, they had this, I remember I saw this video of this Amazon delivery bot or whatever it was, like going down the street, and then some diverse individual just kicked the robot over because why not? Because you know, it's like, what's this thing? And they just kick it over, and then it's just not going to work. Like you see these, videos of these like glossy World Economic Forum promo videos. They'll have some mixed race woman with the curly hair using some like holographic computer or something like that, none of that's going to be reality. If you're actually having these, if you actually have this store where you have to scan your retina to get into the grocery store, and you need to scan a chip on your arm in order to buy a banana or to buy some flour or whatever, buy eggs, do your daily shopping you gotta scan yourself. You gotta have a chip in your hand. What do you think is going to happen in a society that's demographics reflect that of like Brazil? What do you think is going to happen if you try to implement that stuff? If you're living in a favela, people are just going to smash the window and then take what they want and not go through any of this.
Just chop people's hands off to get the implant.
they'll chop the hand off, and then they'll go around with some rich white man's hand and buying stuff with it. I mean, there are no staff in the store anymore. It's all just robots, so the robot isn't horrified by the fact that some sub-Saharan African guy is going around paying with the severed hand of a white man.
It wouldn't be that surprising. I mean, it's grim, but I can easily. I mean, it's like that scene in Demolition Man where it doesn't matter. The point is, I can easily imagine that kind of thing. That's what really scares me about these implants, is that they'll make us tremendously vulnerable. Because people will do things like that. You know, thugs would do that to you. It's awful. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I know that the whole technocratic stuff has kind of gone out of fashion in our sphere. I'm of two minds of this stuff, because I feel that, you know, it could be that this has been pushed back, that maybe they bit off more than they could chew with COVID, and there's this great weariness of technocracy, and they're kind of trying to reel some of that stuff back in, and that could be the case, or it could also be the case that it's just not in the media. And I also want to remind people that just because something's not on your social media feed doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So, I don't think we're totally out of the woods in that regard. Another positive that I noted upon this year, but seemed to have gone under the radar in our sphere as well, is the fall of Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse. So do you remember in 2021 that uncanny YouTube video where Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook was rebranding to Meta, and that he announced that they're going to work on the metaverse? Everyone remembers that video, but everyone remembers like the memes from 2021 of imagining the horrors of living your life in a world designed by Mark Zuckerberg. I'm struggling to actually envision a worse kind of hell, but
yes.
That's been a complete dud. So virtual reality has really not taken, is a technology which I consider to be quite dangerous, because when you imagine what potential virtual reality actually has to sever humanity from its natural form.
Before you go into this, I want to read out this meme about Mark Zuckerberg. I just love this. So this is the idea that he's an alien. Here we go. Here is yet another candid photograph of me and my human family, in which I am exhibiting the mammalian startle reflex that we humans so frequently experience at such relatable activities as parades and street festivals. Do not be startled at the second face extending from my chest, however. Like all humans, I have only a single head. The additional face belongs to a smaller human that I have tethered to my body for ordinary human purposes. I love that. That's so well written. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt your rant. No, but go ahead.
It's fine, but this is something that circa end of 2021, when we were imagining our dystopian technocracies in the future, a lot of people were talking about the metaverse. They're saying, well, this is going to be after they've destroyed society and made life in the real world unlivable, well, they'll give you this thing to placate you. Here's your headset, which makes you where you can imagine that you're living a fulfilling life as you're locked away in this, in this 4x4 pod for all your life. And so the metaverse was something which when this arrived on the scene, a lot of us were horrified by it. But it came up
at the same time as the Great Reset, COVID, yes. In the pod, eating the bugs, all of that. So it really seemed like, okay, the metaverse is the first version, the first iteration of what they're talking about. So it was very, very, it seemed, likely.
Yeah, it did. And even the initial promo for it, so they had this Super Bowl ad with this this uncanny animatronic dog from the 80s or something like that. And the idea is that he's reliving his glory days in the metaverse. So it's basically saying that, hey, your life might be miserable now, but here's a virtual reality where you can pretend your life is good. That's what it kicked off with. The company itself has put over $100 billion into research and development for metaverse technologies. I mean, Moses, have you ever heard of Horizon Worlds?
I haven't. No.
Well, because that's the actual name of the product that Mark Zuckerberg was selling. The metaverse is just a blanket term for a metaverse is just a blanket term for a virtual space congregated into one. So all different platforms in virtual reality that are available on the internet put into one space. That's what metaverse really means. The actual product that Meta Platforms developed was called Horizon Worlds, but you had never even heard of that before. But that was the actual product that Meta was selling. And no one had ever heard of that. No one has ever heard of this thing. And the only thing that they know about Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse is that they want absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, it's quite comical how badly it was executed. So the avatars look like characters from Nintendo Wii, and they don't have legs. So the fully immersive virtual reality. Yeah, the fully immersive virtual reality that Mark Zuckerberg was raving about in 2021 turned out to be double amputeed cartoon characters floating around with little text bubbles above their heads in a world that looks like it was created for a middle schooler's 3D art project. It was a total failure.
I remember virtual reality being talked about. The Lawnmower Man came out in 1992, and I think the opening screen crawl in that film says that by the year 2000, every household will have a virtual reality terminal. And so the idea was that everyone will be jacking into this 3D virtual space and they'll be connected internationally. I don't think the term internet existed in 92, but whatever. So it's a thing that has been on the cards forever, well, for at least 30 years, I'm sure that it obviously predates that. It must, I guess, the early 80s may have been the first time that they were starting to talk about it seriously. I don't know. I know that that glove, what was it called, the power glove or the data glove, I think that was 87 when that was invented. But
anyway. No, then there was the Nintendo Virtual Boy from 95.
Yeah, that was a sort of gimmicky thing, and I never even heard of it at the time. I only heard about it years later, retrospectively, and apparently it made people feel sick, but it didn't. I don't think it was actually. Well, maybe it was. Whatever. The point is, it's something that certainly wasn't technically possible in 92. Wasn't even possible 10, 12 years later when I was writing about it for my degree thesis at art college. But then it seemed much more possible in 2018, 19, when I think they first started talking about this kind of thing. And they were saying augmented reality was that was by the late 90s. There's a Terence McKenna recording where he talks about they're now saying augmented reality. So that's Google Glass and whatever that come about 20 years later. The point is, they've been going on about this for a long time, but it keeps being not feasible because for whatever reason, the graphics just cannot, they're nowhere near good enough. So you end up, and the data that you can't animate people who walk, who have legs, you can't do it fast enough. That baffles me, frankly, because I'm sure that they have this in video games nowadays, but for whatever reason, anyway, the point is, maybe they will crack this one day and be, I'm sure they will. But even then, it doesn't seem like a life that many people would actually be happy having. I think they'd only be happy with it if they really were living in the pod and never saw other people. So this was their only way to socialize.
Yeah. So, one of the positives is it doesn't look like it's going to happen. I just like this technology, they've been trying to get it off the ground for decades now. So, you know, a joke I told was that our theoretical dystopian technocratic futures about the metaverse were replaced by our theoretical technocratic dystopian futures run by AI. So, I mean, that's the other thing from this year. Now, that's something I know we spoke about it at the beginning of the year, but I still don't know really what I would say about it. I think that I think it's predictable that the AI chatbots have all gone woke. That's not really surprising because either A, the people who are programming the AI are woke and they program it to be woke, or B, the sources which the AI uses are things like Wikipedia. And then it eventually ends up aping the regime's talking points because that's where all of its input is coming from. So, I don't know about the.
I wonder about this. You know, am I going to end up in an old age care home, talking to some robot that just talks shite at me all day, like politically correct shite, and you know, drivel? Is that what it's going to be? It's a scary prospect. So go on.
Yeah. I something we spoke about at the beginning of the year, but I don't know if I actually have much different to say about it now than I did back then. It's still something that's developing. I think I think that the thing with AI is that it's just it's gotten better. So I even remember that the art that I was I don't really play around with this AI art stuff so much, but. We spoke about this at length in January and it does look like the new artwork has actually gotten better so they don't have the problem with the fingers and the eyes as much as they did. But that one for me is an open question though. So I don't really know. I don't really know where to go. I don't really know where to go with that one.
I mean, the thing is you can't avoid AI, the AI art. People are going to use it and you can't stop them. I mean, it'd be like saying, look, can you just not swear anymore? Someone can sustain that for a while in that single conversation with you, but they're going to go off and swear. And in the same way, they are going to use AI art, and that is going to come back to you. Even if you find it repugnant and disturbing, unfortunately, it's just going to be everywhere. And I don't say that because I like it. I don't like it, really. I'm intrigued by the creative possibilities of it, but I don't like, well, I mean, I don't like the idea that no one is going to learn any skills in the future, that we're all just going to be telling the computer what we want and it just does it for us. It seems a very retarded existence. That's really my objection to AI art. But there's a whole load of other stuff to say. I mean, it's a huge topic, and I think it's going to be difficult for us to talk about it intelligently until it's more, you know, manifest, unfortunately. Some people just have an effortlessly bad feeling about it right now and want it to go away, and I can sympathize with those people. Unfortunately, as I say, they're just not going to get what they want. It's not going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, I lean towards that, but I guess, like, if the reality is that it's not going to go away, I would say that I just hope that with creativity, it's used as a tool of creativity and doesn't replace the creativity itself, because an AI can't be creative, I don't think. I don't, like, if you say to an AI, write me an Irish folk song, it can write you something resembling an Irish folk song, but it cannot experience the hundreds of years of Irish history that the Irish people went through in order to develop that genre of folk music that is unique to them. That's not something that the AI can go through. So it can only copy what already is there. It can't grow anything creative organically. What that's also related to is I hope that it puts a dent in the hold of the entertainment industry, because that's another thing from this year is the massive hits that have been taken by Hollywood. So they had that writing strike. They had all these blockbuster movies which have been bombed. Did you realize that they released an Indiana Jones movie this year?
Yeah, I mean, I heard about it. I am intrigued to see the first section of it where they de-age him. Apparently, it's incredibly good nowadays, but I'm just curious for the technological aspect.
Yeah.
Everyone said it was crap. I think it wasn't as negatively received as the fourth one, which just seems so.
I've heard it was a lot worse than that one.
Really? Oh well, yes. Yeah. There were people moaning about the anti-white stuff. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So I didn't watch the new one, but I did make a video about it, not about the movie itself, but kind of what it says about the culture and what I titled the video was Indiana Jones and the Curse of the Undead Culture, because what it really shows is that our culture is stuck in this stasis where it is dead in every meaningful way, but nothing new has been created to take its place. So we're stuck with we're stuck in this weird situation where earlier forms are being regurgitated, with woke messaging infused into them, because nothing else has been produced to take its place,
and nothing else is allowed to be produced to take its place. You can't have this is a point that I've made. You couldn't have a character who honestly reflects the way life actually is today. So you've got to default to the Guardian reader of 2007.
Yeah. So, and that, by all accounts, that basically is what Indiana Jones, basically the, what I heard, that the Indiana, new Indiana Jones movie is basically, an 80 year old Harrison Ford being bossed around by a guardianista with a British accent. Yeah, so basically, like, the woke female girl boss.
Yeah, it's just Phoebe Waller-Bridge,
who,
according to Lady of Shalott, was the wrote the screenplay for the film where James Bond dies. I don't know. I didn't know that she was a writer and an actress, but I seem to remember hearing that at some point. Every time I see that woman, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she's so smug. She's so full of herself. It's just nauseating. And I wouldn't be surprised if she has no talent at all and her career is completely manufactured. And I'm not saying that's true. She might have talent. I'm just saying I haven't seen it. And it wouldn't surprise me if she's basically kind of like Greta Thunberg, you know, like they've chosen this girl to just be this fucking annoying, smug, posh, lefty woman to preach at everyone else.
Yeah, well, I imagine that's probably the case. But I mean, another positive of this year is that the grip of the entertainment industry is really starting to wane. Now, there are a few reasons for that. One could be that because younger people are just so absorbed in their 15-second long TikTok videos that they don't have the attention span to sit through a 2-hour-long movie anymore. I mean, that could be part of it, but I think that more so, it's just that their creativity has absolutely dried up, and nothing of quality is being produced by this industry anymore. So, you know, I feel like there is an opportunity for our guys to fill the void. Now, I don't think we're going to be making blockbuster movies of our own. I think that's we obviously don't have the resources to do something like that. However, it's my hope that with the things that are emerging now, I feel uneasy about the whole AI thing, but if it's able to give our people tools to create works of art, in a way that they actually can pull off something that before wouldn't have been possible, I think that would be a positive. So, you know, in the cultural sphere, I would say that they're also, the regime is also losing ground too. So,
Oh yeah, I think that's definitely true. And especially, you can see it most especially with Hollywood, as you said. I think it's dying a death, and it has been for quite a few years now. And it's, there are many reasons for it. And I actually can't remember them all. I listed them all on a Countercurrents podcast once about 2 years ago. Obviously the internet, the people are switching to streaming. They prefer episodic TV stuff, but also the Me Too scandal for what that's worth. The pedophile stuff, I think, is big. The incredible over-reliance on sequels and remakes, reboots, and also that everything has to be so big now. So it just turns off, you know, grown adults who want actual adult drama. You know, people who are fucking serious, who aren't wowed by Marvel superhero special effects and explosions and CGI, like a bunch of bloody adolescents. Adults who are actually adults. Get nothing whatsoever from Hollywood, and the big budgets mean that the thing has to appeal to many, 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 many people, which means that it has to be stupid. So that's why adults get nothing from it. So I think there are various reasons, but I think the main thing is just the wokery, which I think is a symptom of a broader problem, which is that they're just not inquisitive anymore. It's not about real life anymore. It's doctrinaire and low and stupid, brainless, and then you've also got just demographics that are fewer talented white men involved in Hollywood, as there are in every sector, really. And I think you're going to see, just with that alone, you're going to see a decline in quality and originality, because we are the source of those things, generally speaking.
So do you think we should hit the super chats?
Probably time for that. We've been going for 2.25 hours, quite a long time. I think this is the longest one so far, actually, this year. Okay, well, we talked about this, but I'll ask it anyway, and you can maybe answer concisely. Sure. In light of Ban the ADL and Israel's Gaza offensive, etc., how does Endeavor imagine Jewish power being dismantled in the future?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how it would be dismantled. What I would imagine, though, is, like, you know, basically just losing the grip on the narrative. So maybe the media that they control loses its influence. Maybe the academic institutions, which they've dominated for decades, lose their prestige. And I also think that people becoming more aware of the malignant nature, which it has had on the West over the last, uh, couple of decades is that people just will be a lot more skeptical of anything that comes from that from the organized Jewish community than they had been in the past. So, but it's hard to say exactly how that would go. What would happen?
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think it's going to be dismantled so much as it's just going to lose its credibility and its hold and its persuasive power, as we're, especially with regard to the ADL and the whole censorship apparatus. I also think that the West, if you look at something like Hope Not Hate, I think that Britain is going to become so socially chaotic that something like Hope Not Hate, there just isn't going to be a place for it.
People are just going to stop listening to them.
Stop listening. Stop taking them seriously. And I'm not saying that as a sort of optimistic cope here. What I mean is, even if it's bad for us, I think it will also be very bad for them. I think that whole thing, that their era was you know, the 2000s, the 2010s, the world now is so, it is just not comfortable enough to sustain listening to an organization talking bollocks so much anymore. Not like in 2012. Okay, and then Dusty says, thanks for the stream with Endeavor. He's another one of my favorites. Thank you, Dusty. Lady of Shalott. In France, the Douglas Murray book, The Strange Death of Europe, was published with the title The Strange Suicide of Europe. I didn't know that. The publishers must have thought the title was too close to the truth for the English-speaking world. Right. That is interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, open borders for Israel. Has Endeavor been paying attention to Gad Saad? He was one that he didn't come up in our discussion earlier. Up until recently, Gad Saad was pushing radical individualism, but he has now taken a hard turn and is tweeting demographics equals destiny and suddenly exposed himself as very ethnocentric. Even Lauren Chen has called him out on the double standards.
Yeah, I've seen him on Twitter here and there. All I can say is it just speaks to his people's lack of self-awareness. And not only up until recently has he been pushing radical individualism, he still is pushing radical individualism for white people, but then he's pushing radical ethnocentrism for his own people.
The utter chutzpah is beyond belief.
Like, he had that thread on Twitter, one that Elon Musk actually replied to, and one of them, he said, like, something of it was like, individuals take a priority over collective identity, something to that regard. And this is the same guy who had been spending months and months raving about this is the same guy who retweeted another thread that he basically just said, oh yeah, Jews are just, they're just better. They're just better than other people.
I saw that.
And I don't know. I mean, Gad, it's just clear that he has no self-awareness. You know, he's somebody who he can say that he's an individualist and that individual and collective identity doesn't matter. But then when it comes to his own, then, he doesn't hold those own standards for himself. I said, just be skeptical of anyone who prescribes one thing for you, but the opposite for themselves.
Yeah. But also the obviousness of it makes me think that maybe academic agents theory is correct, and actually they're not that bright. They're not like a standard deviation above, because if they were, they wouldn't. It's the same with Jonathan Greenblatt. I mean, it's surprising.
Well, I mean, they might be. They might. I don't know whether it's. I'm agnostic on whether they actually are.
I don't have a position on it.
But they could, even having a high IQ doesn't necessarily mean that you make good decisions, though.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. All right. And Jay says, thanks for thinking of me, lads. It really warms me cockles. Thank you, Jay. That's very kind of you. Magic Man. Okay. It wants to recommend a book. All right. Okay. About Monica Schaefer, the story of her persecution and trials, who was shanghaied in Germany by their captive judicial system. Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. That's Monica Schaefer. All right. I don't know anything about that. Okay. And he also says it all started with the Empire Windrush in 1947. Yes. Yes, thank you. I know about that. I've tweeted about it quite a few times. Good evening or morning, gentlemen. Question for Endeavour. I've noticed the Canadian right is starting to question, very cautiously, the residential school's mass graves hoax and the industry that's propped up around it in the media and government. Do you think this will be allowed to continue?
No, I do not think it'll be allowed to continue, because there is even talks of legislation to make questioning the mass graves hoax illegal in Canada. So, like, if you haven't heard of this, there is no evidence whatsoever. They haven't been able to produce a single body. So, like, they've turned they've blown these residential schools like way out of proportion, and they're trying to, basically, it's superimposing the Holocaust narrative onto Canada. They're trying to make these things out to be, you know, what you'd see in Hollywood movies about Auschwitz. They had this narrative that there were these mass graves discovered by X-rays in the ground near these residential schools. But that happened 2.5 years ago. But since then, not a single body has been excavated. And even if there are bodies there, they haven't been identified. There's been no context of who is buried in the ground here, because most graves are unmarked. Gravestones don't last forever. Most people who die eventually will be in an unmarked grave. And a lot of them have just been graveyards from the past, where just people died because people die because humans die and they get buried. But then they've pushed this narrative that I don't know what you're supposed to believe.
When you when you think about it, it becomes very strange and stupid. Are they saying that the teachers just couldn't be bothered teaching these ethnic kids, so decided to massacre them all?
Well, yeah. My joke was
you're getting killed.
well, my joke is they'd have you believe that the nuns were executing the kids by a firing squad.
Come on, that's ridiculous.
But they haven't been able to identify any of the people in the graves either, because, you know, when somebody dies, you have a record of this person. If someone goes missing, you have a record of the person. That stuff existed in the 20th century, in the early 20th century. If a huge number of people just disappeared, you'd have people that were missing. You'd have the names. You'd have records of all this stuff. Zero evidence has been produced whatsoever for any of this stuff. And to be fair, a lot of people are actually questioning it in Canada, and there actually have been a couple of mainstream media companies who have actually released articles questioning the validity of this. But I think it's going to be made illegal, because Canada recently did this has recently pushed through Holocaust legislation, and I imagine that they're going to try to make the questioning the mass graves hoax, they're going to try to make that illegal. I mean, say what you want about stuff with World War II. There actually were dead bodies. There actually were people who died. The people actually, they actually could identify people who died. You know, there actually were victims to what they're claiming. Whereas the stuff in Canada, they have no evidence of this whatsoever. And it's also funny because a couple of decades ago, like the narrative around these residential schools has been getting more and more absurd as the years go on. So it just like you saw with these Hollywood movies about the Holocaust, it would always get more ridiculous with each rendition. There were people in as recently as the 1990s, Native Canadian people who had attended these schools as children, who said, yeah, my experience was pretty good. You know, I learned some good skills there. It was not bad. Now, I mean, I don't mean to inculcate guilt over any of this, but these other historical atrocities that they claim take place, none of the people that, you know, claim to be survivors of them were ever saying, yeah, you know, it was kind of nice. You know, the concentration camp, it was kind of okay. I learned some good skills there. You know, it wasn't until it was decided that this was this horrible thing that they started talking about it in this way. So for many decades, people just thought, oh, it was a school that people went to and they learned to speak English and or French, and they learned to do math and how to work in a trade. And now it's, oh, well, now it's Treblinka they that they're being sent to.
That is
unbelievable.
But this is real, you know. I mean, we can laugh about it. And, you know, I was maybe, I don't mean to trivialize it. I know how serious this is. And it's just incredible to think that something could be manufactured with no evidence whatsoever. And within a few years, people are talking about making it illegal to deny it. I mean, is that looking like a realistic prospect that it will actually become like Holocaust denial?
It's realistic. It could happen. There's been talk within the government of making it illegal to question the alleged suffering of residential schools and of Native Canadians at the hands of the horrible, evil, racist white man. There's talk of making that illegal. So yes, it could happen.
Fucking hell. All right. And Darby actually said this year, some politicians in Canada are pushing for Holocaust-like hate speech laws as a result of it. Yeah, we'll discuss that, but thank you, Darby. And then ML Printer says, question for Endeavour. Will the Sikhs, let alone the Muslims, stand for the recent construction of another 55-foot Hindu god statue in Toronto? So how will the other Browns feel about this?
I have no idea, and I don't care. I just want the thing gone. I think it was actually Brampton that it was being built in, which in Ontario it's called Brown Town. It's the town where all the Indians and Pakistanis move. I don't know though. I don't know. It's just going to be a big eyesore. I don't really care how the Muslims feel about it. I just want the thing gone.
So is it actually a permanent fixture? I thought it was like for some festival.
I guess it actually is a permanent fixture.
How tall is 55 feet? That must be. Is it? Well, that sounds huge. Anyway, I'll look into that later. I did see a photo of something, but I'll look into it. All right, well, that's all the super chats, and we've been going for 2.5 hours. So that is quite extensive. Well, this has been great. I've enjoyed it. I've been quite tired throughout it, so maybe a bit more loose than I usually am on Millennial. Endeavour, any final things to say?
I guess I'll finish by saying that I think that this year has been a good year for us. And that's how progress is going to come. It's going to come gradually. So don't get discouraged because there isn't going to be some based and red-pilled right-wing candidate who gets elected and then brings us victory overnight. It's not going to happen like that. It's going to be taking ground gradually. And I think that we've gained some this year. So reasons for optimism. Merry Christmas to all. If you want to follow me, I'm still on YouTube. And I'm writing on Substack too. And I'm back on Twitter now as well. I've started posting there as well. So thanks for having me on again. Always enjoy it.
You're very welcome. Okay, well, I will be back tomorrow night. Let's see who will be on. Stefan Kort, I think Korty, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Then Jared Taylor. Then Furious Pertinax. And then Black Pilled. So that should be quite an eventful night. All right. Excellent. Okay. I will see you all then. In the meantime, Endeavour, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. We'll be right back.